All right. Can folks hear me? Great. So, I wanted to just say, first off, how excited I am to be here. This is the second year the Chronicle's done a Chronicle Tech Trends at EDUCAUSE, and it's valuable for us. We hope just to even organize our thoughts and share some of the things we've seen that excited us and actually some of the things ahead that we all want to look forward to watching. I have one program note, which is I'm really sad to say that unfortunately Jason Jones from ProfHacker, the co-founder and co-editor of that blog, which is on the Chronicle's blog network, wasn't able to make it at the last second for tweaked his back, and he's not able to join us. But he is going to be blogging, of course, and he had his presentation all set to go, and I think it's going to be a provocative set of notes about that might challenge some of the themes at the conference. So look for that on the ProfHacker blog this week, very soon, and it's chronicle.com/ProfHacker, as you probably already know. But our format is I'm going to talk for a bit. Mark Perry, my colleague, is going to talk for a bit. Mark is a tech reporter extraordinaire at the Chronicle. I'm sure many of you have talked to him or seen his work. I'm the tech editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education. My name is Jeff Young. I've been actually at the Chronicle pretty much my entire career, about 16 years, and I love it. I love covering higher education. And I haven't always covered tech, although I've done this space quite a bit. And it's been, obviously, as you all know, it's an exciting time right now with technology on campuses, and one in which I think, you know, I've never seen such mainstream interest, so many glossy magazine articles that mention college tech, so many radio shows on NPR, TV appearances, and by people talking about the kinds of issues that you guys are on the ground doing every day. So that's been really exciting to be on top of it. And the Chronicle is trying to stay on top of that. Just a quick note in case you haven't seen these things. We've done an ebook this year on 12 profiles of tech leaders that we thought were doing some interesting things. We have a MOOC mania package of stories inside MOOCs, but with stories by Mark and I and some other people. And we just recently did a series on reinventing the university, asking the question, what if college were reinvented from scratch today in this tech age we're in? And a quick, very quick thing, if you go to our booth in the exhibit floor here, which is 725, you can get a free copy of the ebook if you're interested in that. So I want to just talk today about five shifts that I see in my work that I think tie together a lot of the big themes that are going to come this year and that have come in the past few months. And so it's always hard to narrow it down, but I think these encompass a lot of the things that we're really watching at the Chronicle. And I think of all those people I mentioned, the kind of changers, game-changing folks in higher ed, and I'm sure people will argue with me on Twitter or elsewhere if you disagree, but it seems to me, as far as the conversation about change in higher ed and technology in ed, it seems like Sal Khan, who I probably don't have to explain too much to you folks about, is one of those people that has really been the most influential. And here's someone who's not a higher ed person at all. And he gave this talk last year at the TED conference, which I'm sure TED Talks are very, you know, this is viewed millions of times since then. And I was actually at that event. I've been trying to go to TED forever. I happened to go that one day, the one time I could go and see. And the room, it was really striking. There were a lot of, you know, they have speaker after speaker. It's kind of, you get sort of numb almost to these amazing speakers that they have. But this one speaker, kind of everyone in the audience, it was a standing ovation, and people seemed to be buzzing about, and this, you know, it's a highly Silicon Valley crowd in this room. And it was kind of like, oh, this is something. And it was almost like a feeling of subversiveness, I think, for a lot of people to hear this person who is kind of, that just sort of says you can just do different kind of teaching. You don't even need a university to be involved, which of course challenges folks at universities in interesting ways. And so I think there's been, I'm not going to go too far into these things that have been getting all those press that I mentioned, but, you know, people like Sebastian Thrun, who designed the self-driving car for Google when he's not redefining higher education or trying to. And he's a Stanford University computer science professor who ended up getting a lot of press in the New York Times and, of course, in the Chronicle and elsewhere. And he had 58,000 students in his free open class. He saw the Khan talk at TED and said, I'm doing that. I'm opening up my class at Stanford because of that. And so he had 58,000 students. This article ran, and very soon you had 160,000 registered people for the free class. 160,000 was a number, I think, that people that got people excited in new ways that that even people that had been thinking about these issues. And so then he did this thing, and we were watching this. I think it was in February. Sebastian Thrun was speaking at this conference in Germany. We were watching online in our offices, and he said, having done this, I can never teach at Stanford again. And it's easy for him to say. He also works at Google. And he took a leave to go start Udacity, which some of you probably have heard of. And, you know, I think this is kind of, here's this professor striking out on his own. And I think so shift number one of the five sort of big shifts I see is this idea of professors bringing their own classroom. I was just listening into some of the session this morning that was packed about bring your own devices. There's Gartner was saying that BYOD is a big thing coming in businesses of people, you know, having such good consumer laptops and smartphones that they iPads and tablets that businesses would want them to have access to everything on those devices instead of providing. I think professors probably still want their free laptop or whatever from the college, but instead it's they have this power now to bring their own classroom, so to speak. And here's Tyler Cowen sitting on his couch at home in Fairfax, Virginia. This is a professor who is one of the most popular economics bloggers. He's an econ professor at Mason. He runs this thing called Marginal Revolution Blog with another colleague. It's got over 200,000 unique visitors a week, which I think is more than a lot of actual, you know, publications out there. And he just does this in his spare time. And he was sort of saying, you know, I can do a MOOC in my spare time. I can do a classroom. So he and his colleague released Marginal Revolution University, adding the word university to their blog name and creating this new site. And so they're bringing their own classroom and making it up themselves. I asked the provost of George Mason, because Mason, you know, I'm presumably would want to be involved with MOOCs. It's the buzzword and everything. And I said, but this project, Marginal Revolution University, it just lists Mason at the bottom as like a supporter kind of in the corner, whereas everything else is like all about these professors and they're the stars. And so I asked the provost, what's in it for you? Why did you set it up this way? And the provost said, we had no idea until it was pretty much a done deal. They told us about it in central IT and administration when it was pretty much done. So, I mean, this is an example of the kind of thing that, you know, I think the idea of the prof not needing to come to the IT or maybe working with some folks that not might be the traditional channels. And so I think the legacy of MOOCs for the folks at EDUCAUSE and at a lot of traditional universities will actually be less of a, I mean, maybe it'll redefine every bit of university life. That's kind of exciting to write about, and maybe it will over a long frame. But I'm curious, I think in the short run, and I might be naive, we'll see how it all plays out, that it seems to be making technology teaching cool among a set that wasn't the early adopters in a way that, you know, people have seen Sal Khan on 60 Minutes or read these glossy articles, and they think, and honestly, it's not a new idea. It's just whether more people will come to this idea. The Prof Hacker blog, as I mentioned, here's the logo, is been saying this and making it look cool for years. And it is, but this is the question, is can it spread? And so I think there's also interesting change in some of the business folks I talked to. We've called this the year of the EdTech startup. There's a boom time for EdTech startups, it seems. The Startup Alley in its second year here at EDUCAUSE, I think, is kind of evidence of that. I chat with one of these CEOs for a new company, Piazza, which is one of the many new companies, and it offers classroom discussion tools for profs. But I asked her, you know, what's your business model? Typical question. She was basically like, I don't want to sell to universities. She's sort of avoiding institutional contracts. Because in a way, I mean, she didn't say it in these words, she was more diplomatic, but it wasn't cool to be attached to the central IT. She wanted profs to kind of find it themselves and choose themselves. Of course, professors choose the software you offer too, but there's some kind of vibe that I was interested in about this culture of like, oh, it's the thing that is out there in the cloud and is some really hot new tool that is that's the way they're positioning themselves. So this attitude, I think, is a shift. And of course, colleges are already reacting to this way before, you know, even before that company came out, is Internet 2 has this Net Plus services you guys are all familiar with probably, of the idea of, okay, well, if it's going to be Dropbox or Box.net, than people using file sharing. If they're going to use a cloud service, why not have the university be involved? And so Internet 2, which of course has built pipes for so long, is now, interestingly, in the game of brokering deals between software companies, some of them quite major, and universities, to have a contract that maybe follows FERPA and the federal privacy rules more carefully than otherwise might be there, and to sort of say, well, we expect the profs will build their own classroom, so to speak, and so we want to be a part of it, but we don't necessarily want to have the exact same role, or we may not be able to have the same role. So the other thing about, you know, cloud is, this is from the data that Casey Green's Campus Computing Survey came out with just this morning about LMS moving to the cloud. And you see just in this, in all types of universities, it's slowly increasing. And so the idea of the software being the kind of service on the cloud that people have in their consumer lives is really coming. So, it's who knows where it'll go, how far, but I feel like that's a big shift. And so it's just a new relationship. And there, I think we'll expect also more outsiders to get in the game. I was very curious to talk to this 35-year-old gentleman who is in Indianapolis making lecture videos. He was doing it kind of on his couch in his living room, but then he got a budget from YouTube, which selected him and his brother among a bunch of, you know, video bloggers, and they said, we'll give you a budget to make your educational videos. They're quirky, they're irreverent, they're fast-paced, they don't look like something that are being offered by universities. I'm going to play a very short clip of it if it'll work. And so here is a very fast-talking person. If we can skip the ad. We can skip the ad in 3 seconds. The magic of the
open. Hi, I'm John Green. This is Crash Course World History, and today we're going to talk about the Cold War, which actually lasted into my lifetime, which means that I can bore you with stories from my past like your grandpa does.
When I was a kid, they made us practice hiding under our desks in the event of a nuclear attack because, you know, school desks are super good at repelling radiation.
Mr. Green, right, remember in elementary school there was this special guest who defected from the Soviet Union and he had,
like this crazy Russian accent, and he kept going on about how Reagan hit in Gorbachev's face instead of signing treaties with him.
And I was like, whoa, dude, calm down, you're in a room full of third graders.
And then for months afterward on the playground, we'd play Reagan Gorbachev and spit in each other's faces. Those were the days.
Sometimes I forget that you're me from the past. Yeah, it's just really nice to talk to you and feel like you're listening.
You're boring. Cue the intro.
Okay, so this is a different kind of, you know, video lesson. And it does, I asked him how much something like that costs to make versus Tyler Cowen's lecture on his iPad. By the way, Tyler Cowen, who I showed earlier, he does all his recordings with an app he bought for $4, and just uses screencasts from his iPad. But this one, meanwhile, they wouldn't tell me the budget, but it was very expensive. They have an animation team and some Canadian firm, and there's a kind of production values that you might see, you know, on TV. Not what you would be typically seeing even on the MOOCs that are being all the rage. And I think this is interesting. I think, you know, there's no reason, Sal Khan sort of showed that there's no reason it has to come out of higher education. And so I think you'll see more outsiders. I don't know if this means that, you know, it raises the question, why are professors the ones that make sense? If you're going to prepackage a video, maybe you find an actor or somebody who has more experience as a talent than this person, John, he doesn't have a degree in world history, even though that's what he's teaching, but he hired his high school history teacher to write the content, and he just puts in the jokes and makes it young and lively or whatever he, you know, it's just a different way to think about it. And some professors are also probably able to do that, but maybe others aren't. So shift two, just moving on a little bit, is I think a real change, and I think it's going to really affect the kind of, you know, many of you here in different places, even if you're, I think in the old days the campus bookstore was dealing with textbooks, but I think there's kind of a change on, it's not just this, like, is the e-textbook coming, because, but really about what is an e-textbook. So there's one, if you can see my pointer, this is why we've had articles, and I probably wrote some of them that are sort of embarrassing if you look back, that says, this is the year of the e-textbook. Here it is, this year. Well, we've said that a couple years, and this is a 2% amount, 2% e-book sales that are pure e-books. It's so small a slice in that color you can hardly see it. So it has not taken over the world. But I think the interesting thing that's changed, and you know, through my prediction way off, and I didn't see this, is that what you have is the reality, and this is at some major campus bookstores, it's hard to get really solid numbers on how many e-books, but this is the sector that's more and more students are seeing, which is a bundle of some of it's digital and some of it's print. And the digital is a little different than just, it's not just a PDF of a book. It's, you know, homework questions, lecture videos, you know, different material that they're experimenting with, discussion sections that are with software backing it up. And that's the thing that students are actually seeing, way more than this 2% experiments. And, you know, custom is there, and print is still the majority, but, you know, I think that's not necessarily always going to be the case. And so there are tablets. This is just a quick ECAR, a Pearson Foundation survey about, you know, tablets on campus are spiking. They've tripled in the past year. But tablets are not necessarily where these e-books are going to be the most home. There have been some experiments we've written about that found students running for their old textbook, ironically, even though they're so digital, because they felt like it wasn't a good experience on the tablet because it was just kind of clunky. And so what I think is the publishers themselves are more pushing this new kind of textbook. And I'm jokingly calling it the object formerly known as a textbook, like Prince, the artist who's changed his name to a symbol for a while. It's kind of, there's something new going on. It's not necessarily going to be called a textbook. And I find that even the publishers of textbooks, when I interview them, they don't want to call their new enhanced textbook a textbook, which is hard for me because my editor wants me to write a story about something you guys have heard of. So when I say to them, well, you know, it has one of these words I've heard from companies. It's a module. It's an educational fractal. I was like, what is that? A nugget, which then the PR person said, no, we don't want to use the word nugget. That sounds terrible. Chunks. No, that was the one that was chunks. No. Chunks doesn't sound so great. Nuggets is okay. So, but nobody, I think, has decided what to call these things. And so, I mean, I think I still have to use a little bit of e-textbooks as a crutch because they are learning materials. They serve the purpose of a textbook, but they have all these roles and changing aspects. So I welcome on the Twitter feed, people throw out suggestions, help us out, coin the term that will be the new textbook that is this new kind of beast, at J.R. Young or hashtag new textbook. So here's a quick story that I met this person, Luke Thomas, University of Maine student. Here he is. Now he is one of the people that has one of these hybrids. He was in a class, a 250 person in-person class, you know, with an online component, a hybrid type of thing. And it was called The Nature of Story. It's sort of an intro writing course. It, you know, satisfied the writing requirement. And so a lot of the things they had to do was discuss. And it turns out you had to buy not only the textbook, but a code, access code, to get to the textbook publisher had created some sort of online discussion area. And you couldn't get to it unless you had the code. And it counted like 10% of your grade. So the students really wanted to get to this discussion area. And yet, he was in it. He was an older student. He was taking the class with his wife. They were in the same class. And they wanted to share a textbook. And so the deal was $150, you get the code and the book. But you can't buy them separately, and you all had to have a code, otherwise you don't get your 10% of your grade. So he raised a stink and made a case out of this at the university, went to the campus bookstore, tried to go to the publisher, tried to go to the professor, had a lot of trouble. At first they told him, no, it's just you have to buy the package deal. It's the only way to go. And then he eventually won over. The publisher allowed him to buy the code for $20. So for $170, he had one book and two codes. But I think it's the kind of, you know, it raises all these questions about what is a course material, how do you fairly get to them, what is the future of the used textbook market. Well, if there's no such thing as a textbook, there's probably no such thing as a used textbook market. Very interesting times. And so you have just one example, and then publishing companies, I think, increasingly don't even see themselves as just publishers of books, like I said. And so a couple quick examples we've reported on. Pearson bought for $650 million, which, you know, that seems like a lot of money in the world we cover. MBNet, Compass, and John Wiley and Sons, meanwhile, spent $220 million, I believe, I saw reported that they bought DellTech.edu. And so there's this move to digital by the five major textbook publishers. And I think what you're seeing, what to look for, is a kind of a format war going on between who will control the new platform that all of this is going to be on. At a session I was just at the other day where we were talking about textbooks, somebody said, a publisher talked about a salad bowl. It'll all be like in a salad bowl that gets mixed together, which I like salad because it's kind of like eat your greens, you know, and I want to be eating this, but it's, although people like salads these days, but so the salad bowl, who's going to control the salad bowl that mixes all together, free content and paid content and question, homework questions and video, and I don't think we know the answer. Maybe there'll be kind of an iTunes store of textbooks or the new textbook type. the chunks or nuggets or whatever. And it'll be interesting to see who would win that space. I think a lot of people would like to be that player. So I think that's something to watch. And the whole business model of textbooks. I mean, the idea of buying a textbook at the campus bookstore, like I and many of you probably did, the idea of the rite of passage, you go into the bookstore and you get your books, and you might do it every semester, especially at the beginning of the term, and I mean, the year you're first getting there. But I think this notion is possibly already going away. Students increasingly just either go online to Amazon, go on other sites, rent them through some other means or through the bookstore. But I think with the e-textbooks, this is if it turns into something totally different. It doesn't make sense necessarily that the campus bookstore is going to be that hub. And so you have experiments that that have come across in the last year or two and have grown quickly lately. Indiana University and now Internet 2 is working with about 30 universities to try where the university is actually the one distributing the e-textbooks, and the bookstore is not involved at all in some cases. And the idea being that the university can get a better rate, and this is coming in some cases out of the CIO office, out of the central IT, to say we can get a great rate from the textbook. We'll promise sales, and we'll promise, you know, this sort of no use textbook. It's very attractive to the publishers, and so they'll make a better deal than they would make the ideas. Of course, it does cut into student choice, and so whether this model takes off or not is still open. But you know, then the students still kind of want to be in control and feel like they could buy it used. So in the short run, I think it's going to be an interesting thing. And I have heard one person told me that on some campuses that are considering this pilot project, the bookstores are blocking this and not interested. So it's always interesting in this world. So shift number three, some big things I'm seeing here is, this one is no surprise, there's so many things on the program here at EDUCAUSE, the rise of data. And Mark Perry is going to talk in a minute more, dive into the data aspect because it's so important. But so I won't say much about it. But I will say that accountability is the counterpoint to it, that I wonder whether people are thinking about that as much. Maybe it's a fear that people are not telling me about. But I got the chance to interview Bill Gates this summer and sit down with him for over half an hour, talk, you know, as the head of the Gates Foundation. It's a very powerful force these days, about, you know, their agenda of who they fund for next generation learning grants and other things through, I think, you know, they work with EDUCAUSE, they work with others to give grants for tech education. And I think, you know, he's become somebody whose opinion is of interest to people. And so there was one thing he said, it's very short. I'm going to play this clip if the tech cooperates.
They don't have very good metrics. What is their value added? You know, if you try and compare two universities, you'll find out a lot more about the inputs. You know, this university has AT scores compared to this one. And it's sort of the opposite of what you'd think. You'd think people would say, well, we take people with low SATs and make really good lawyers. Instead, they say, well, we take people with very high SATs, and we don't really know what we create, but at least they're smart when they showed up here. And so maybe they still are when we're done with them. So it's a field without a kind of clear metric that then you can experiment and see if you're still continuing to achieve it.
So, you know, it sounded so matter-of-fact and all, you know, nice. And of course, I was sitting there thinking, wow, that's actually kind of a interesting notion if it was followed through on. In other words, the idea of having data to check whether universities and colleges are actually making students smarter when they come out than when they came in, that's kind of something that gets people talking. It sounds a little bit more like the way K-12 has had high stakes tests, and you know, whether I think he's not the only one, I think that wants to kind of get at that if data starts to flow. And a lot of you all are working in offices, various parts of the campus that are starting to have more data than ever, and there are good things you can do with it, and there's exciting things that we write about, you know, in the research and the teaching in the library. But it's also a really interesting thing to see how universities are faced more and more with justifying themselves, so to speak, in a way that I've never seen in my long years of covering education, higher education, is, you know, the question of, like, wait, why is the cost that much, and what is it? Is it worth it? You know, that's a question I think is still new to college leaders, and it's one that I don't think is going away anytime soon. unless you're at a university that's going to slash your tuition by half or something. So I think this data is going to be kind of a double-edged sword potentially, or cause some interesting debates. Shift 4, another thing, I think this is going to sound a little more fuzzy and soft and mushy. So I may may change my minds on this one via Twitter or some other discussions afterwards. But I've been really interested. A book that came out last year by Sherry Turkle, talked about Alone Together and this always-on culture. And she has a college-age daughter. She's seeing that the social aspects of what students are doing with technology, overkill or over, so many devices, so many things, and so much time using that. And so, is there a role for colleges to kind of somehow be involved? It's interesting, though, because colleges, if you think back, universities were so early at the internet, so early in PCs and some doing these laptop requirements to show students how amazing, these tools could be. And yet, it totally worked. And as pushers, you guys are the best. And the university, the students have totally bought it, and others too. And so now, is there a role for universities to step back and say, use it responsibly? This is getting a little dated, but Harrisburg University of Science and Tech, a small university, tried a week without social media. We actually had, I think we had a reporter there who said that actually most people cheated and most students couldn't do a week. At Johns Hopkins University, I recently toured a library expansion they have, and they've put in these clever lockers for laptops and smartphones that have charging, that have wall sockets and a locker, and you can use them for free. And the idea, put your laptop or smartphone in there, lock it up, go to class, come back, get it later. Seems smart for a residential college, and we've recently reported that other campuses are trying this. But some of the people that came back and talked to us about these lockers, especially for smartphones, is that students wouldn't do it. They wouldn't lock their phone in. It's too crucial. They just couldn't live without it, even for the charging duration. So they preferred charging stations if they could just stand near it at the dining hall and plug in, like at an airport. I think, the flip side of this, which I already am hearing in some of the sessions here, is of course, if you don't, if you don't curb the usage, where does it go for just supporting it? The number of devices, I just had to add to this slide the iPad mini. Every one of these things that comes out, I get real excited, but then I look at the stack of devices that are charging every night on my dresser, and it's embarrassing. I was going to take a picture of it, but I'm like, you guys get the idea. It's a lot of devices, and now you add another, and you add another, and another, and you have also a challenge of just supporting all that. And at University of Missouri, just to give you a quick example, they actually had a kind of a device overload when they had 8,000 devices come in compared to 900 the previous year. If anyone's out there from that university, please tweet me or get in touch about how it's going since then. I haven't had time to check back. But, obviously it was a wake-up call. And now since then, how many more devices have been released, have come out, and Christmas has come and gone again, to students. So a couple more quick things, and then I'll turn it over. But I co-host a tech podcast for the Chronicle. If you haven't heard it, it's called Tech Therapy. So my co-host came up with that one. I don't claim credit, but he already realized that people need a little bit of kind of therapy when they're dealing with technology issues. And so we interviewed two people that I'm sure are very familiar to you. Freeman Hrabowski was a speaker here, a keynoter here a couple years ago. Jack Seuss is very involved at UMBC. We interviewed both of them separately about their personal technology use. It was very interesting to hear Jack say, and it was really interesting. It was kind of a huh. Now that you ask me, I am addicted, in a good way. So it's not just students. This causing to dig deeper into the personal time. Everyone expects an answer. You guys all know this better than I do. And the interesting thing to me was that he said, I'm reaching the limit of what I can do. I mean, he was looking for any advice to how to manage that technology, not necessarily to go cold turkey, but to sort of sift it out and make it manageable. And that was, he wanted an app or a suggestion on that, if anyone has that. And then Freeman Hrabowski, meanwhile, such an optimistic guy, was not at all negative. He was basically like, I don't know if this is good or bad, but I am connected to this device like I am connected to my mind. And it basically is like, think of a time where you're not on your cell phone in some fashion, either you know, to use, like, you mean not just the phone, but texting, or, you know, approving something with the web, or this, yeah, I'm like, all that. Oh, no, I'm never not doing that. And so, you know, he was like, well, I get a lot done, and, you know, maybe it's good or bad. I don't know. I haven't had time to think about it. So I think there's an interesting challenge there, and I don't have the answers. Luckily, I don't have to have the answers. I just come up with the questions. And so a last shift that I'm seeing that I think there's, again, some things reflected here at this very conference on is I wonder, okay, so all these things that we mentioned about, you know, the importance of all those devices potentially and students having all these devices. And if you think about the flipped classroom, well, that assumes you're going to have broadband. If you live on a campus, of course you do, but what if you're at a community college, or what if you're a student who doesn't have access to some of these things? And so this is one where I really feel like I'm a little bit out on a limb. It's something that's kind of come to me in the last few days, and really just thinking about, well, if it's true, so laptops took a long time to get to a kind of saturation point where people could really kind of say, between laptops and desktops, we don't have to worry about it. We might still provide some, you know, campus clusters for convenience, but it's not, you know, we don't have to do laptop requirements. You don't see a lot of new people jumping into that. Some people have kept them. And so the sort of personal computer has come. But you have all these other things. More than half of residential four-year students have a smartphone. Tablets are growing so fast. E-readers, not just the Kindle, but I was surprised it's 12%. And so this is the new e-cars survey, the data that just came out. And so, you know, this was the other thing on the e-car data that was really interesting to me. The question of the importance of devices to academic success. And these are growing, I believe, you know. Sure, the desktop is there, or laptop, you know, that's sort of skews with the ownership number. But if it comes to be true that to really be a student in the modern age, that you have to have a smartphone and an expensive contract for data, and you have to have as well maybe a tablet, or it starts to raise questions about, will there be more talk of digital divide after what I've seen is many years in this country of not as much talk about, you know, that kind of talk. I mean, there's been some grants for broadband access and that kind of thing, but I haven't seen as much about that. So I wonder if it's coming. And then the other kind of digital divide, of course, in a touchscreen world, is accessibility. And so, you know, there's already been challenges with the e-textbook pilots on Amazon's Kindle of, wait a minute, does this work for blind students? I expect we'll see more growing pains around accessibility. And there's even a video being released, I believe, this week. It's already up on YouTube. We just blogged about it on our Wired Campus blog about some of you, maybe some people in this room, talking about accessibility and how important it is for colleges. The takeaways before I turn it over, this idea that profs are hacking the academy or they're doing their own thing, and that can be great. You know, I've talked to folks the people who support learning on technology, and of course that could be a great thing, especially considering conversations you may have had several years ago where you're, you know, begging someone to try it. But it also presents a kind of a new conversation with new issues. And, you know, students may be overdosing, and not just the students. And, you know, outsiders looking in, either doing some of the stuff that only accredited colleges used to be seen as the ones doing, and or, you know, asking a lot of pesky questions, the kind of questions that you usually only hear from someone like me. What is this really about? How does it really work? Is it worth it? And that just adds up to big challenges for folks like you, and I don't envy your role, but I'm very excited to watch what you come up with to figure this all out. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to, I'll queue up the thing here, to Mark Perry, and then we're going to open it up to questions from you. We're going to leave at least 10 minutes or more for questions, so I hope you're already thinking of some, or challenges if you want to take me down on any of these and say what you think is wrong with what I said, or you have your own spin on it. So thank you.
Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Jeff. That was a really great sort of macro level portrait of what's going on in education technology. I'm going to do something a little bit different, which is to basically drill down into one topic that really fascinates me and that I've been doing a lot of reporting on this year, which is big data and data mining. So what's really interesting to me is how this is starting to change how we
how we think about colleges. I mean, we think about colleges as places of sort of intuition and serendipity. You know, a professor sees a student's face and they look confused, so they repeat their point. Or, you know, someone's roommate takes a psychology class and they decide, oh, I want to be a psychology major. Or they meet someone else on the quad and that person ends up becoming their wife. And there's just seems to be a whole bunch of interesting efforts to try to basically bring hard data to all of those different aspects of college life. It's kind of an abstract topic, so I'm going to try to ground this in some concrete, specific stories from reporting I've been doing. And I'll introduce you to some people that I've met. So this is Ricky Erivan. She's a freshman at Arizona State University, which is a hotbed of data-driven experiments. They're doing all kinds of different things. And Ricky had this dream that she always wanted to have a career working with animals. She saw an episode of Animal Planet about zookeepers who work with rhinos and giraffes and big animals, and she was like, yes, this is what I want to do. So she got to college, and she majored in biology, and she thought that's what she would end up doing. Things didn't go according to plan for Ricky. She got very overwhelmed. She dropped a class, she did badly in biology, and soon she started to get these alerts in her email inbox and in the online student portal. Basically, the computer system that Arizona State has was telling her, you're off track, you're off track, you're off track. And basically what she bumped into is this system that they have called e-advisor. Have any of you heard of this system? Yeah. It's basically sort of a system for monitoring how students are doing in their degrees and monitoring their progress, and it lays out in pretty rigid specificity what they need to take and in what order. And if the computer system detects that you're not signing up for a key class or you're not doing well in it, it starts sending out these alerts, and if you're off track twice, two semesters in a row, you have to change your major. This is sort of indicative of a whole bunch of other systems that seem to me variations on this general idea. You may have heard of this system at Austin Peay State University. I think Tristan Denley, who designed it, is actually presenting in another room right now. His system sort of mines historical data to recommend courses for students, sort of like a Netflix-like system. And they're even predicting how well you're likely to do in a particular class as part of their recommendation. So they're steering students toward classes in which they're likely to do well. And you can understand why this kind of stuff is taking off. There's a lot of pressure to improve graduation rates, and this is a way to make everything more efficient. But what's interesting to me is this is starting to have a real effect on students' lives. So this particular student, when she did get in to see her advisor, she was told, sorry, you can't be a biology major anymore, you have to change your major. And they sort of talked about a bunch of other options, and she ended up being a creative writing major and still sort of hoping to get back to her dream of being a vet. But it's not clear that she'll be able to do that. So her path through college has been rerouted by this system, basically. So for all these different trends I want to tell you about, I'm going to sort of also talk about some of the tensions that each of them raises. And I think the interesting tension here is just whether college is still going to be a place of sort of serendipity and discovery, or whether we're going to just sort of have the computer find the best path for students and sort of nudge them down that path. And this is a quote from a privacy scholar who I interviewed, who was somewhat skeptical about these systems. So that's sort of the advising realm. Another interesting area that big data is starting, data mining is starting to take hold in, is the classroom, especially the online classroom. So this is Adam Lang. Some of you may know him. he works for Ellucian now, but a few years back, he started working at Rio Salado College, and he was a 22-year-old undergrad when he started working there, and he's sort of just totally obsessed with data and has some interesting personal hobbies. You can see there's a cat there. So in his spare time, he's basically converted his home into a surveillance lab for his pets. And so that cat has an eating disorder and sometimes forgets to eat. So he attached a scanner to the cat's collar. And when the cat leans over the bowl, it logs that the cat has eaten. So he's monitoring to see like whether this cat has eaten or not. He also set up a webcam next to his fish tank to figure out what sort of paths his fish were taking and how far they travel and stuff like that. And so at Rio Salado, Adam started to get really interested in the behavioral data that students left behind. And as you know, these online courses, they sort of capture this huge wake of clicks, you know, stuff like when a student logged in, did they open a syllabus, did they turn in their assignment, and he basically started looking at whether you could take all that stuff and model the patterns of successful students and then basically use that information to try to intervene with current students who seem to be going off track compared to the historical data, basically. He said there's a predictability about the fish. The same concept applies to students when he was telling me the story about the fish. And again, this is a system that was put in place at Rio Salado. So what they built basically is sort of a color-coded alert system that, based on your behavior in an online course, professors and students get sort of warnings about whether they're on track to complete successfully or in a gray area or whether it looks like they're going to fail. But there's other systems in this same general area that are sort of working on this same general idea, which is, you know, monitoring what students are doing in online classes and trying to use that information to help them. So another system is this Newton system, which you may have heard of. This is another student. This is a student at Arizona State also. His name is Jeff Wattel. Newton is basically this online tutoring system which records massive amounts of data about what you do, and it tries to give you personalized recommendations sort of about what learning activity you should do next. And it's starting to really change what classrooms look like. You see this kid, he just rolled out of bed, got on his skateboard, and came to this math class. But the classes that use this software, it's not like a lecture kind of class. It's basically a giant computer lab, and all the kids are working on one, sort of focused on their computer. And there's professors and teaching assistants that sort of wander around, but it's really the computer system that's in charge here, in a sense. And if they need help and they get stuck, they can ask for help. So I think that this is another really interesting area where big data is starting to take hold. Also some really interesting tensions here and challenges. Some of them are just technical challenges. Like with the Rio Salado example that I told you, they ended up having to take that system down for a time because basically, they had updated some of their courses, and when they did that, it totally skewed the calculations that they were making, so wrong predictions were going out to the students, which obviously is a problem, so they took it down and are working on an improved system that may be back up already, I'm not sure. And then with some of these other systems, I mean, there's a question of whether this stuff is actually grounded in research and really really what they're advertising is makes sense. I mean, some of the companies are talking about trying to, you know, give students who seem to learn better with video rather than print videos rather than sort of print materials based on the data that they're getting, you know, there's, as far as I'm aware, there's no evidence that there are students who learn better with video over print, even though it might seem like an intuitive thing. And there's just sort of a basic, a more sort of philosophical question. I mean, what's the role of a professor when an algorithm is basically recommending the next lesson for a student rather than a professor? So those are some interesting things there. The last area I want to talk about is libraries, because I think big data is starting to raise some pretty interesting challenges in the library world, too. This is David Weinberger. Some of you may have heard of him or read his books. He's an author who writes a lot about technology. And he's now head of this innovation lab at the Harvard Law School Library. And libraries are in a really interesting predicament right now, which is that historically they've been really staunch defenders of privacy of patrons. You know, it's considered good practice in libraries to basically purge records of who borrowed what books. So if the FBI comes along, you know, you don't have the record, you can't give it to them. But now, you know, as they move into all these digital services, basically the modern internet is much more social and personalized, as you know, and all of that basically thrives on collecting personal information about users. So that's a pretty difficult situation for libraries, and David is trying to work out some projects that try to take advantage of what you can do with data in libraries. One of them is called Library Cloud. It sort of reflects a little bit of what Clay Shirky was talking about this morning, actually, about what you can start to do when you have a lot of data and you share it, and people do all kinds of things with it. So he's basically built this software that collects metadata from all these libraries. Metadata is basically information about information, you know, helps you find books. And he's built a system where libraries will be able to use that metadata to build recommendation engines and things like that. And here's just an example of the kind of things you can start to do with data in the library world. This is a browsing software which is basically trying to pop out books based on their community's use of them. So the stuff that's in dark blue is more important to the community, in this case Harvard, but it's based on how many libraries own the books, how often they're borrowed, and things like that. So rather than just searching for a book, which is the traditional way of doing things, you can start to take advantage of the community's, what the data from the community shows about the book's histories. So I'll just end by talking about some of the challenges in this area, which are, because of these privacy rules, they can't even collect records on which books are taken out together. Like, you think about Amazon as basically watching everything you do and everything you buy. In the academic library world, they can't use records that I, Mark Perry, took these two books out together, which you could imagine could be pretty useful. You know, you have The Origin of Species is often checked out with some commentary. You might be able to build a useful recommendation tool based on that, but they can't do that because of these privacy challenges. So I want to make sure we have time to get questions from you guys, so why don't I just stop there. We can throw it open to questions.
Please come to the mic if you're able to ask
questions. Yeah. So yeah, at the mic here.
Yeah, hi. My name is Jeremy Frumpkin. I'm the Assistant Dean of the University of Arizona Libraries. And I'd like to just challenge that last point you were making about privacy rules. I do think that it's challenging to be able to aggregate data and not link it back to individuals. But as long as you're not linking the data back to individuals, you can capture that kind of data. What books is oftentimes circulated with other monograph or other items. You just can't link it back to individuals. So I'm not sure
right.
If that's specific to a particular institution, But in general, that's allowable data collection.
But you could use that to do. You could use that to do what, though? You're saying.
So you were making the point that it's difficult to say take gravity's rainbow and see what other material was checked out at the same mm-hmm. time.
Right.
Well, as long as we're not relating that to Joe user, specific Joe user.
Right.
You can aggregate and track that sort of information. You just can't bring it back to the individual themselves. So I think that there's a lot of potential there for actually leveraging that data and actually utilizing it that we're not restricted to.
For things like purchasing or things like recommendation? Because, I mean, this is just what was described to me by them. I think one of the issues is all of this is in such flux right now, privacy on the web, that people really don't know what the norms are and what is acceptable. So maybe they're erring on the side of caution and, you know, you feel that some of this stuff is okay.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of literature on this. And just say that a lot of folks do err on the side of caution, and so you may run into that. But there's a lot of potential and a lot of utilization, especially in the United States, of being able to use this. I understand that sometimes the laws and the some of the norms in Europe and other parts of the world are a little more restrictive on that, and so that may also be the case. But I'd suggest that you might be interested in looking at some more of the literature and some of the research that's been done in terms of data gathering, aggregation, and analytics in the library community.
Okay. I'd love to hear more about it. Mark Perry, can you go back to the first
slide? I'll put our Twitter feeds up here.
I'd welcome if you contact me and show me some of those examples. That'd be great.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Jeff, this is a more question for you. Brad Cohen, University of Minnesota. Prof Hacker was your first instance, the first trend. What about Student Hacker? It may be an increased appetite for self-certification, alternative badges, and flow, being able to flow credit between institutions. And so could you talk a little bit about those trends and where you see that going?
That's great. I believe one of my colleagues uses the word swirling for students who want to mix and match in a very loose way. And of course, students have long transferred from, say, a community college to a four-year, but this new era of, like, you know, do they take one course on Coursera and get a little credit from through, you know, some for-profit provider, and then they go another course here, and then they end up, their alma mater turns out to be, you know, one of the traditional universities. And I think that is, the Student Hacker is definitely a trend. I almost didn't mention it, not because it's not important, but because it's one that's been talked about a little bit. I mean, there was the DIYU book a couple years ago that's still talked about. And I do think it's definitely not going away, this idea of now with all these MOOCs mania, you know, MOOC mania, I think that's it's probably growing as far as a reality. Now, you know, the idea was kind of floated, but it's starting to be more and more the case that maybe there's a way for students to do that. And so the student hacking of the academy is going to challenge the university. And so I think that might be why you have so many universities jumping so quickly into experimenting with MOOCs. It seems like an accelerator rate compared to other trends that I've seen in the past. And so that fear of the student hacker may be exactly why.
Hi, my name is Heather Hiles. I'm the founder of Pathbright, which is a Web 3.0 digital portfolio. And my question is to both of you, actually. And it's about big data. We're pulling student data into our portfolios for the benefit of learners to own their own data. And I wonder if you saw a trend that we see a lot, which is about the liberation of student data, so that students own their own data and it follows them rather than being hoarded in the institutions.
So a pressure, do you mean, are we seeing trends of institutions actually doing that? Or
supporting it? Yeah, supporting it.
Well, we do have an article we wrote on this, how this is a tension I'm hearing between these kind of new companies often, maybe like yourself, and colleges who have their old-fashioned way of seeing data as just guarded and not giving it away.
Right.
And I think there's talk of even regulation or talk of opening up, either forcing or at least thinking about how to have universities come together to agree on some standards maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in watching that space.
Isn't that what the education department wants to do?
Data Palooza.
Exactly. Yeah. They've had some meetings at the ed department.
I don't know how far along that is.
That's the thing. So definitely if they've moved on that, let us know, because it's something that is a big, I think it's part of these big trends to watch.
The Department of Education is looking to open up student data and to make it available, and lots of companies like ours are pulling in that source of data. But in addition to that, we're doing a pilot with Stanford University where they're actually introducing authenticated transcripts and giving them to students through our portfolios. In addition to that, ACT, the testing company, is allowing us to provide electronic authenticated test scores through the portfolios. So I think it is a trend that's inevitable, at least from the student perspective.
Interesting. Thanks.
What's Web 3.0, by the way?
So Web 2.0 is cloud and that sort of thing. Web 3.0 is big data. It's using the data to optimize learning outcomes.
Okay. I haven't heard that.
Always another number. Do we have, are there any questions from the online that, or maybe not? Okay, great. Well, we'll stick around afterwards and certainly would love to talk even further, you know, beyond this conference even. But thank you for listening. We really appreciate the chance to talk with you and look forward to talking to you afterwards. Thanks.